It's an English evening, sorry. But now the German speakers will maybe puzzled about the English. Know what's happening. But again, in English, so just to frame the evening a little bit, I will start with a guided meditation, and then followed by some reflections, and then also an opportunity for dialogue that we can exchange some notes, some thoughts, some feelings on our personal experience on Dhamma. And the time frame is 9 o'clock this evening, so plus minus 5-10 minutes. It doesn't have to be exact Swiss time, it can be flexi time. Okay, so please sit comfortably in your own space, wherever you are. Doesn't have to be a formal meditation seat or a mat and a zafu or so, but can just be your chair and your sofa even, but not too comfortably. Direct your attention towards your immediate experience. Meditation can be a very complex or even complicated business if you want to make it that way. And certainly there are a myriad different techniques and methods to choose from nowadays, Buddhism, but also beyond Buddhism. But here in this context, we want to start in a very simple way, in a very direct way. And the best way to start is to give oneself one particular motto. And that motto is to absolutely accept everything, to allow everything to be as it is in this moment. To allow absolutely everything, what you experience, be it your physical experience, your mental experience, your emotional experience, just allow everything to be as it is. So this may sound even simplistic to some ears, but it's very important that we do that, because if we starting meditation with a preconceived idea, even a programmed idea, what we want to achieve, what we want to, how we want to feel at the end of it, maybe we want to feel calm and relaxed if we feel agitated right now. Maybe we want to get rid of some negative emotions we experience right now and have more feelings and emotions on the positive side of the spectrum. Maybe you want to get rid of some unpleasant physical phenomena which we're experiencing right now. But as soon as we do that, as we project ourselves even just a little bit into the future, and that future is in this case the end of this meditation session, then we are moving away from from the immediacy of our experience. In meditation, in this context, the Dhamma context and the Buddhist context, starts always very immediate, right here, right now. We've all heard these phrases many times. We get encouraged and reminded of this over and over again. But strangely, ironically, over and over again, we keep forgetting. We sit down, and before we know it, we're in some kind of inner dialogue, some inner movie, which is playing itself out. Some people have it even visually. Some people have it more in terms of words. You just have the audio switched on, and they hear the inner voices talking to them. But whatever it is, if that's the case right now, at this moment, allow that to be as it is. Because if we're doing that, then what it does, it brings us in direct contact with our experience as it is right now. We're not moving away from the immediacy of our experience, but we are right here. So that's a very important starting point. We take our time to really connect the physical side of our experience. What's your body like this evening? Not what it looks like, but how it feels like, if you're feeling into the body. Just being interested, wanting to know maybe the finer nuances of your physical reality at this point in time. It doesn't matter if you feel very energetic or feel tired and a bit listless. The most important thing is to acknowledge what it feels like to live within your own skin, so to speak. And then we can go from there, we can go and include the other areas of our personal experience at this time, at this moment. But as the emotional life, your emotional reality right now, in other words, quite simply, how do you feel? What is the mood of the evening? Is it a mood which has been there all day? Is it a mood which had just come when we started to meditate? Is it no particular mood? Is it just some kind of vague sense of something which may not quite clear what it is? And please don't try to find labels, descriptions, mental descriptions of your mood or what you're experiencing, but just trusting the felt sense, the feeling into your experience, letting that particular form of attention which guides you more and more into the details of your experience, let that be your guiding light. No need for mental labels. And then, of course, there is maybe the temptation to find mental labels, especially if you're a mentally very active person. Some of you have maybe very active mentally today, especially if you're working with your mind, then sometimes it's a little bit of a challenge to switch gear in the evening. But we don't want to have special thoughts. This is not the idea. And even let alone, we don't want to get rid of thoughts. This is sometimes people's wrong understanding that meditation is serving us to get rid of thoughts, especially, of course, the thoughts which we don't like, the challenging thoughts, the ones which we give ourselves pain, the critical thoughts, dismissive thoughts, etc., etc. But we're not here to evaluate our thoughts. Just notice there is mental, if there is mental activity, just notice it. So in this way, getting an overall view of the different areas of our experience. We're taking on all the time of the world. We're not in a hurry. We're not trying to get somewhere quickly. We're not trying to get rid of something. We're not trying to achieve something. We see the tendency in the mind, maybe, wanting to get rid of something we don't like, wanting to have something which we do like. But this is all mental habit, mental program, which we are not following. Instead, we are just here to acknowledge, to be fully aware of this, of our personal reality. And then, after a little while, we are much better equipped to decide what is the medicine, I would call sometimes the meditation the medicine. What is the medicine we would need tonight? Because it's not every day the same, is it? We're not using one meditation method from now to the rest of our lives, the end of our lives. What would be good? What would be helpful? What would be suitable? Would some stimulation of the heart be suitable to stimulate wholesome, beneficial emotions like kindness, compassion, patience, forgiveness? Would that be something suitable for this evening? Would we need maybe to establish a little bit more focus with a more focused meditation object in the area of the breath and the body? Maybe that's what we notice right now. After we've had a first glance at our overall experience, yes, I think tonight my mind seems to be a little bit all over the place. It'll be good to hone it in, direct it to a particular place, a particular area, a very noticeable one, tangible one, I would recommend. And of course, the classic object is the breathing in the body, the breathing of the body, to use that to establish a more sense of presence. Because if we hone in on that meditation object and the whole oscillation of the mind calms down somewhat, then we're in a much better position to receive that which we're supposed to receive tonight. We're supposed to acknowledge and then let go. So we're not particularly interested in the contents of our minds, especially the verbal messages, but maybe also then orienting also on the context, giving ourselves a context from which we can observe, receive, and let go in a very unstrained way. Just the right amount of effort, not overstraining ourselves, not pushing, not trying to manipulate our experience. Just be very alert, very much here, very switched on. And futile to call ourselves bad names, to criticize ourselves or judge how we're getting on. Whenever our attention drifts, we find ourselves somewhere else in the universe, but not here. Just gently orienting back, coming back, establishing access to our chosen focus, be it the body breath, be it the development of wholesome emotion, be it just being, staying very open and receptive for whatever that comes, without picking and choosing, letting the heart, letting the mind become very spacious and open. But this has to be, of course, something which works for you, which is something you can stay with, not just for one moment, for a few moments, a few more moments. Sometimes doing a very focused meditation approach, we might find ourselves in the middle of it contracting. We're zooming in too strongly. Then it's good to widen the focus, soften a bit, open up to the totality of our experience, rather than becoming more and more contracted on one particular object. And this is what we could call developing the skill of meditation, to assess for ourselves, to know for ourselves what is suitable, which doesn't make the task too hard, too demanding, but makes it just right, just right, just enough to stay present. It's all that we want. And also concerning our general attitude, just know there is definitely no failure in this. You cannot fail. We can only learn. We can only learn from what we're experiencing. We can learn from the cul-de-sacs. We can learn from our limitations. We can learn from our potential. So failing is not an issue here. Notice also your face, if you are having a sense of looking too grim, which some of you might have, just put a little smile, a gentle smile on your face. It's also an act of awareness, of being aware of not getting or turning this into a grim exercise. We have to grit our teeth, but we can enjoy this. Meditation can be an enjoyable thing, if you haven't noticed yet. So in the same way as we moved into the meditation tonight, we are going to move out of it, the formal meditation that is. So there will be no bell. So please gently open your eyes, reorient in the space, the room, the place you are, look around and being aware of that impression, that the visual sense is coming back into operation. So after the inner world, now the external world at least to some extent, becomes also an issue. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ sanghaṃ namassāmi. So tonight, I want to begin with a question which we are very often asked as Buddhist monastics, but maybe not even limited to monastics. And the question is, especially if one moves outside of the so-called Buddhist context, the Buddhist world, so to speak, and meets people in different realms of the world, different physical locations, and so forth. We very repeatedly put the question is, what do Buddhists believe in? What do Buddhists believe? And, well, of course, when one is asked a question, there's not just a text message. One tries to answer. Usually that's what I do. I don't just see myself as an automatic answering machine. but of course, you always want to, or you try to sense where the person is coming from. So if the question maybe is asked in a kind of provocative way, you might even decide to stay silent. But if there's a genuine interest, then one can, of course, say, yes, well, I don't really know what most Buddhists believe in. Because if you talk to different people who have a leaning towards Buddhism, or if you're close to Buddhism, or even call themselves Buddhists, and that's not really self-evident in the Western world very often. Nowadays, you meet a lot of people who do Buddhist meditation retreats, who practice along the lines of the Buddhist teachings, but they're very shy to call themselves Buddhists. But of course, you can't, when you ask that kind of simple question, one doesn't want to give a too complicated answer. And so when I want to give a very simple answer to that question, what do Buddhists believe in? I can say, well, I can speak about what I believe in, even though I do think that Buddhism is not a belief religion or a faith religion as such, even though faith plays a role in Buddhism as well, as in many other religions, but certainly not a religion which is based on blind faith, that you have to accept some kind of dogma or some kind of teaching passed down through the ages, and because it's written in certain holy books, you have to blindly accept it. In fact, it is just, in the Buddhist context, even against the recommendation of the inventor, of the historical Buddha himself, who said that we should always investigate ourselves if the teachings are actually applicable and work for us. We shouldn't just blindly follow what any authority tells us, any teacher, or even the scriptures are not to be blindly followed and believed in. And to come back to this, to my answer to that question, I would always say something along the lines of, I believe that the human heart can be transformed. The human heart, the human mind, or the heart mind, whatever you like to prefer. But the Buddhist path, the Buddhist practice path, is about a transformation. And the transformation is from usually, putting it mildly, a fairly ignorant or blind view of oneself, of the world, how one operates within the world, and the particular driving forces we're under. We could also say our social conditioning. We all have received and are molded by our conditioning, the conditioning of the society, by our parents, by our primal caregivers, by teachers and so forth, and all the other influences we were under, especially when we were little, when we were children. We are very impressionable as children. Those of you who have children have could observe that children, they're like sponges. They absorb what is presented to them like a sponge. Just take it in immediately. And a lot of it is actually, of course, unconscious, because we don't have, as little children, we don't have the mental faculties yet to decide, well, this is, might be good, this might be not so good, but we just absorb whatever we present it with. So if we're living in a very beneficial and kind and loving environment, then of course that is very conducive to our development, to a good development. If we're living in an environment, maybe in a war zone or in an abusive environment, and then our development is fundamentally impaired, we will eventually come up against great struggles in our life, which can take us right into late adulthood before we have worked through the results of that particular action, that particular karma. But I don't want to talk about extreme cases and extreme forms of conditioning, but just the humdrum, the normal conditioning which the normal person, so-called normal person, gets imbibed with. And this usually is not so too challenging to give it a close look with the tools and the skillful means which we have available in the Buddhist context. So the different meditation methods and practices are all geared towards us to become more conscious, to become more aware, become more fully, you could also say, to become more fully a human being. And when I speak like that, to become fully a human being, is that's a human being which is conscious and aware. It's not directed by unconscious forces, by forces of habit, as we also very often call them, and which then very often lead us into trouble, because these forces of habit, as I said initially, they're not always necessarily very good ones. We could also act upon forces of habit which are not conducive to our contentment, to our happiness, or let alone to our peace of mind. So there we have practices, we have skillful means, and in the guided meditation, we were diving in a little bit to find our way forward, to move forward in our direct experience, and that is wonderful. And this is supposed to be something which we should cultivate and develop over a lifetime. And because if this statement I would give to a person who asked the question, what do Buddhists believe in? If I answer this with transformation, then a transformation of the heart, of the mind, can only happen if it's under the guide of a total commitment. So we have to be committed to this particular path. And committed to the path means it's not just a pastime we do once in a blue moon or whenever we feel like it, or when we maybe go into special situations like monasteries or retreat centers and do a course or so once or twice a year, and the rest of the time we lose the plot, so to speak. That would not really be very conducive to the transformation of the heart, because we are, of course, We are not only conditioned by what has happened in the past, but we're also conditioning ourselves in the present. We're conditioning ourselves in, ideally, in a wholesome way, in a good way. So if we notice that we have a tendency to be very negative, have a very negative attitude towards the world, other people, and of course towards ourselves, usually that goes hand in hand, goes together, then that might be an indication for a certain particular practice to apply, not only once when it's really bad, but you know, on a regular basis. So we'll be kind of paving the ground for the mind, the heart to incline in a different direction. So away from the habit of negativity, of moaning and whining and calling ourselves bad names, maybe even, but towards a heart which experiences a lot more joy and contentment. It's a lot more ready to attend the needs of other people, to be helpful and supportive, to be acting from kindness and compassion. And this is something we can gradually develop, and this needs to be nourished. You know, we also can see that the Buddhist path is a path of developing nourishment for the heart. We nourish our hearts. If we don't nourish our hearts in a good way, in a wholesome way, it usually tends to contract. It tends to get more narrow and narrow and narrow as life goes on. We get more and more stuck in our habits. We can only tolerate a limited amount of variation of what we think is right and true and wholesome and so forth. And we have to blend more and more of that out what other people present us with. Or our heart can also even dry up. Maybe we can have a sense of dryness and, you know, just like a dry prune, feel dry, and there's no juice there and no life. And even, dare I say it, enthusiasm to live our lives, the things we do, but also in general, how we encounter the life, other people, the world, situations on the whole. And so nourishing is one important aspect. But also another aspect, of course, is, as we're talking about conditioning and that which conditions us, that we also shouldn't lose sight of that which is not conditioned, which is, as in the Buddhist words, which is unconditioned. And that sometimes makes people frown a little bit and scratch their heads and think, what is that? What is unconditioned? What is not a result of, you know, the conditioning of our lives, what we've inherited, what we've received? Is there a way we can, in a very realistic way, get a sense for that, get a feel for that, get even in touch with that? So, for example, when we go into meditation and we sit down and we focus the mind, we become maybe reasonably focused, maybe become very directed towards a particular aspect of our experience, the thoughts arising and passing away, different moods and mental emotional states, which we can witness also arising and passing away, of course. But then we also sometimes are encouraged to be aware of the gaps. Even when we're just attending to our thoughts, we can sometimes notice, well, there is a gap between thoughts. Even though those of you who have that sense of, well, I just keep thinking incessantly all the time, there is no gap. That's why we're meditating. We're meditating to see and detect there are gaps between thoughts. In fact, if there wouldn't be gaps or space, it's another word for gaps, if there wouldn't be space or gaps between thoughts, how could thoughts actually even exist? Thoughts need a context. Thoughts need a context to appear within. there's no space, no gaps, well, how could thoughts even be? And so that's a very interesting suggestion for ourselves, right? To direct ourselves towards the gaps or the context, the space, which is also there, if we care to attend to it. Because very often we overlook it. We're so occupied with the contents, with the objects of our experience, with the thoughts, the feelings, the emotions, or the physical phenomena and so forth, that we overlook, oh, there's also that, there's space, and there are gaps. Well, right now, when I stop speaking, there's also silence. This is similar, it's an analogy which along similar lines, when I'm silent, you hear, and you suddenly become aware there's silence. You might have been following just the words, and you might have added your own thoughts to the words which you've been receiving and hearing from me. But have you also been aware of the silence that is, in that respect, the context within which, you know, now at this given time, my words come across to you? If there wouldn't be silence, how could there even be? If there wouldn't be the background of the silence, how could there even be words to be communicated? So in our Dharma practice, we're looking very often also in the direction of those things which are normally or commonly neglected or completely overlooked. Who cares about space? Huh? Who cares about gaps? Who cares about openness and so forth, spaciousness, or even a very common Buddhist word, or emptiness? This is not really stuff of the world, is it? People in the world don't talk about those things. They talk about stuff I want to do, stuff I want to achieve, what I want to accomplish in life, the aims I want to get to. You know, we're always filling our minds with new projects and new ideas of what we want to direct ourselves towards as the next thing, the next project, the next situation in our lives, so forth. And that's within certain limits. That's quite a normal thing to do. And I'm not asking anybody to just abide in emptiness now to the rest of your life. So we'll be a little bit asking you a little bit too much. Just to also acknowledge in your own experience, in your own personal experience, that there is not only that which is conditioned or based on that which is conditioned, which is our whole thinking, feeling, emotional process, but there's also that, the greater context within which that is taking place. And so when we're talking about the practice of mindfulness, for example, or awareness, and those are exactly the practices which connect us in a very practical and direct way with that dimension. If we are aware, if we're mindful, we're not following the contents, we're not following the activities and the contents of our mind. That would be defeating the whole purpose of it. But rather, we're stepping back. We take a step back, asking ourselves a simple question: what is this? What is this right now? And if it's sometimes we experience something, we can experience very beneficial, very wholesome states of mind, very wholesome, noble emotions, even altruistic emotions and feelings can arise. And this is wonderful. And those things that we can acknowledge and say, yeah, this is a tendency within the mind I'd like to encourage, I'd like to make more of, I'd like to make stronger and integrate into my life, into my daily life. And for that integration to actually be real and working and be something which can service, we need to have a little bit of a structure. We here in the monastery, we have a given structure. Monasteries provide a structure for us to live within a life which includes all these elements which I've just mentioned. But when one doesn't have that, when one is, and I don't think I'm making wrong assumptions about you, when you're living out there in the big wild world, then it is very helpful to have a structure for themselves, an outer structure, an external structure, but more so also an inner structure. The inner structure, of course, is usually covered by our ethical commitment, that we have very clear ethical guidelines. You know, we don't compromise in the area of ethics, of right speech, right action, right livelihood. That is a very clear priority for us. And as I'm saying, livelihood, which you can extend to not only livelihood, so the work sphere, but the rest of your life, how we live our lives. And if this is having the foundation of ethics, of ethical integrity, then we really have already something going for us. At the very least, we have a very good basis, a fundament. Is that an English word, fundament? A basis. We have a basis to build our house upon. And then rest of the practice, the more meditation practices, and the application in our daily life, they can rest upon that basis. If we don't have that basis, then the application of daily life will be very wobbly, and we will be doing one way like this and the other way like that, and we are always in that state of uncertainty and not quite sure what is right, what is wrong, you know, because there's the necessary clarity is missing. We don't have that strong commitment to ethical integrity. And so that's why in the Buddhist teaching we're very strong on this point. I don't want to get kind of go into great details on this point tonight, but just to stress that this is a very basic point, which also sometimes actually gets overlooked or gets dismissed as not so important. Meditation is what we need, you know. That's what transforms the mind, that transforms the heart. Yes, that's true. Meditation transforms the heart, transforms the mind, but only a meditation which has a good basis. If it doesn't have a basis, your meditation will be floating up in the air and it will not have the necessary grip to really implement a fundamental transformation. So that eventually your inclination towards more negative states of mind, negative states of heart, get more and more a non-issue. Because you have not only the basis of meditation, but you also have seen that these things don't serve you very well. You have a very good tool available in the area of your meditation practice, which does not let the mind slip automatically into these modes of habit, of automatic pilot. So we're creating new and wholesome habits. And this is not yet the total transformation, but it's a good piece along the way. It's a part transformation. And the real transformation, when the heart is completely transformed, that, of course, in theory, can happen anytime. In the Buddhist scriptures, there are countless stories and events where these different stages of awakening people experience experience very suddenly, very abruptly. But I think what is very often not mentioned is that maybe these people also did some preparation. Maybe if they didn't do their preparation in this life, they have done some preparation in other existences, who knows? But nothing comes out of the blue. There's always the law of karma in operation. If we are sowing good seeds, good karmic seeds now through our action with body, with speech, and with heart and mind in this very life, in this very moment even, then these seeds will eventually grow and they will be to our benefit. But like all seeds, like the seeds in the garden, we need to water them. They need sunlight. Sometimes they need fertilizer. So we come back to the nourishment. We need to nourish the heart. When we nourish the heart with these various skills, skillful means we have available, then the seeds will eventually open, they will eventually sprout, and will stick their little heads through the earth, and suddenly, miraculously, a little plant appears, and out of this little plant might even later on grow a huge big tree. Well, the same for us. Huh? What might not look like very much in our meditation right now, but we keep nourishing. We don't get discouraged by, you know, by our overtasking ourselves and expecting super results too quickly. But we just keep nourishing that which we find to be of value, of benefit for ourselves. And that has to be, of course, testified. We have to testify ourselves. Is this good? Is this wholesome? Does it make the heart lighter? Does it bring more joy in my life? More benevolence? Do I become less reactive towards other people? For example, it's a very good indicator to become less reactive and more allowing, less critical also in sense of negative criticism towards yourself, other people in the world around you. That's a good sign. Sometimes in the world, the classical sense, it's a bad sign. We've all been encouraged in our upbringing to develop critical mind, at least in the Western world. In the East, it hasn't been so much a big issue. But we are, and this has very often turned around and turned against us. We can become, and I think most of you can testify that, incredibly self-critical, putting ourselves down unnecessarily and undermining the very potential we have to transform the mind, to really change this fundamental habit, because that's all it is. To putting oneself down, to be hypercritical towards oneself and negative, is just a bad habit. That's all it is. Thank you for listening.
I just have a question. Maybe it's too personal, but how was your personal development in meditation through all over the years? Yes, that I would like to know. Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean, yes. Astrid is your name, yes.
Yes.
I know what you mean. Just let me get you a little bit bigger. How was my development?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And when you meditate today, yeah, so how many hours is it per day? I would like to know a little bit more about the practice, yes, in your way.
Yes, well, where should I start? It's quite a time span to look back. I started to practice meditation, when was it? More than 40 years ago. And of course, initially, you have certain ideas about meditation, which then, in the course of moving on, change. I was very influenced by the teachings, I must say, right from the day one. Well, not from the day one. I was initiated into Buddhism, the Tibetan tradition, initially for just a short time, for 3/4 of a year. And then I met Lompo Someto, who at the time was almost like a conduit for the teaching of Ajahn Chah. He had just arrived in England at the time, and he was very full of what he has received of Lompo Cha, Ajahn Chah. So that really had a very strong impression on me. So I was very enthusiastic. And just imagine, and even in 1978, when I first met Ajahn Someto, he was already speaking about mindfulness. There was, you know, mindfulness and letting go. Those were his teachings for me anyway, on the day one. And so this has, of course, accompanied me all the way through, right up to this point in time. But of course, in the course of so many years, you meet other teachers, you're living, you know, I've only lived with Ajahn Someto together, actually, maybe 3 years in the community on the whole. But then, of course, met him from time to time again, but met other teachers, spent time in Asia and so forth. So you pick up different inferences and impressions and so forth, and suggestions also, because you also go through phases of doubt and uncertainty and wonder, is this right? Is this, am I getting anywhere, you know? And just like anyone else, I was having my fair share of doubts and uncertainties and so forth. But strangely, one thing I must say, once I decided to enter monastic life, I never looked back. I never doubted that this life has great value, in terms of transformative value. So I noticed, well, it's very difficult for me to look back, you know, how I was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. But when I feel inside of myself, I mean, it still feels the same me, you know. It's not a different me now sitting here now than it was when I was sitting at Lompo Zambeto's feet 40 plus years ago. But something has happened. And I should also maybe say that I was not coming to Buddhism as someone who was suffering a great deal. I was more, you know, I wanted more, you know. Worldly life wasn't offering me enough. I must admit, I was also at one time quite a hedonist, you know, a lot into sensuality and sensual pleasures. And I remember then someone was telling me, well, if you meditate, you know, it's even better. So I thought if I start to meditate, it would be even more pleasurable than sensual pleasure. That was the promise I was given. But it wasn't straight away, actually. It wasn't like that. It was more that I was more coming more and more. Actually, that took quite a while, coming more to the ground, you know, with my feet to the ground and becoming more real, what my actually motives were in the spiritual life. You know, maybe I had to make some adjustment. I did have to make adjustment, rather coming from getting and wanting, you know, wanting better experiences, wanting more samadhi. You know, there was a lot of talk about samadhi, of course, in our circles, the unification, the collectedness of mind, or sometimes also called concentration. And I tried very hard to become a great concentrator, and I completely failed. I was not very good at it. But I learned to live with being a failure in the concentrative realm. And I realized also that's not the point, actually, to become very concentrated and very super focused, you know. In fact, we have a very nice word in German for samadhi, which is called Sammlung, for those of you who speak German. And Sammeln means to collect. So to collect the mind, bring the mind together, to unify. Huh? And very often it's misunderstood as if it's to be one point or one area, to unify, to bring the mind together from the kind of frazzledness, the distractions and the unnecessary things of life which don't really serve us very well. So in that respect, you know, my life has become a lot more streamlined and a lot more, it becomes more, you know, my life in the monastery is as normal for me as your life is for you out there. Just, of course, the context is different and the support we have and we feel very much held by the structures and by the community, the Sangha and so forth. That is, of course, a great bonus we have. And so that's why in my little talk, I was trying to also include that, to point to that. It's good to have a structure at place, you know, and if you don't have a local sangha or so forth, but to give yourself a structure at home, certain times where you, quality time for yourself, let's just call it quality time, let's not even call it meditation method time or meditation practice time, but quality time where you can really be quiet, become very still, focus on your immediate experience, And also maybe also include that which I brought in at the very end to see, yes, this is my experience, but there is more to life than just that what's happening from moment to moment in my brain, in my thinking mind, or in my emotional life. So to connect to something larger, to something bigger, to the spaciousness of the mind, we could say. And that's, of course, also something which our teacher, Ajahn Sumedho, is very good in pointing out. You know, not get fixated and even fanatic about trying to manipulate one's experience, so the contents of the mind, to clobber away at your defilements and so forth, or trying to eradicate the things you don't like and try to hold on to the nice experiences which you do like, but more, you know, letting the experience be what they are, but not identify with them. Loosen the grip of identification is also another way of putting it. Because our habit tendencies is a continuous tendency to identify with what we experience, with our thoughts or feelings, mental states, and so forth. And then we feel surprised sometimes that we get stuck. Huh? We get more and more into a narrow place of our personal experience rather than a wider and more open space of our experience. So, well, of course, I could talk on, you know, there's a very large question you put there, Astrid, huh, that is, but I think I'll leave it for that. So maybe someone else also has something to, maybe something more specific to bring it to mind. Okay, here it is. Jayanti and Paramito to everyone. Ajahn, please, would you share some skillful means to develop motivation when the daily practice becomes a little stale or routine? Yeah. Yes, Jayanti and Paramita, I know what you definitely know what you're talking about. Monastics are definitely not exempt from having experiences of the practice becoming stale and a kind of routine, humdrum. You go about things in a very mechanical way. You sit down, you put your cushion there and plonk yourself down and close your eyes and maybe even light candles and incense before you do all these routine things and sit down and then maybe you have a little watch or some mindfulness bell or whatever to remind you when the time is over. And then you discover half an hour later you've been thinking all the time. I certainly had this experience. I know what it's like. You know, get kind of into this kind of routine habit of meditation. I think then it's good to really make a, if we realize that, then really make a break, make a strong gesture to ourselves. Okay, this can't go on. This has to be done differently. It could well be that it's a different approach in meditation, that could be. But it might actually also be that it's to stop meditating completely. Not forever, of course, and not stop being conscious and being aware or being mindful. Not that. I remember years ago, one of the historic events in the history of the Sangha in the West is there was a retreat in Amaravati when Lompo Sumedho observed that everybody was very hard trying to get into some concentrated state of mind. And he saw the grim faces and the miserable expressions on people's faces. And so he took a very radical step. He said, from now on, I want you still to come to the meetings, to the meditations, but stop meditating. Of course, for some people, it was really a shocking message. Stop meditating. I mean, I'm here, I'm a monastic, in order to learn how to really meditate perfectly. And he's telling us to stop meditating. Well, he was telling people still come to the meetings and still to be conscious and aware, not to switch that one off. And so people did, and apparently I wasn't there at the time. It's a long time ago. I don't know if he would still be so daring nowadays. And apparently it was good, had good results. People were saying, yes, this took me out of that kind of a stuck place I was. I was in some kind of, and to use your term, a stale routine of, you know, trying to get somewhere with my super focus, hyper focus. But I wasn't really noticing and acknowledging what I was doing. I wasn't aware how I actually went into the meditation. I didn't, to use my words from the beginning, I didn't allow everything to be as it is from a start. But I was trying to get in there and trying to change things according to my preference. So maybe I noticed I was thinking too much or getting distracted all the time, sidetracked, dreamy, dream states. So I was trying to overcome that. And then the expression on the face can become very grim when you do that. So, of course, this is just a story, but there can be, of course, other ways we can do to help ourselves to get out of a kind of some stale position and a routine which doesn't seem to be serving us very well. Then just we change the routine, change maybe the duration. Maybe if you have a duration, a habit of meditating. I remember I used to have that habit of having to have an hour. Even when I was getting very dopey towards the end, I had to have an hour of meditation. So I was shortening it. I realized it's much better if I only meditate 40 minutes. Serving is much better. Or maybe people out you might be meditating 40 minutes and still finding themselves, tying themselves into knots. You might shorten it to maybe 25 minutes or 20 minutes. But it's the quality of our presence, the quality of our awareness which counts. It's not the duration. It's not the duration of time. So the quality of our presence of mind, and that, of course, implemented beyond the formal meditation periods, implemented into the rest of our daily life, that should be the decisive element to find a way to getting out of stuck habit patterns. And sometimes we have to just, as we say, throw up the cards, you know, completely, to get really a bit of a distance from a very strong habit. If we still find it difficult, that this habit might not shift, and we find it back getting into sleepiness or very stuck places inside ourselves, then, you know, using the body more, doing standing meditation or walking meditation. Of course, admittedly, in warm climate countries, that's much more easier to be implemented. But using the body proactively to, again, reestablish presence of mind, presence of consciousness, and then move forward from there. So don't just, even though the virtue of patient endurance is highly recommended, especially in Thai quarters, highly recommended, Kanti Paramita, but it's not the patience which you see on the face of a water buffalo. If you have been to Thailand, you know, you see the buffalo in hot temperatures standing in the field. That's not the kind of patience which is usually required. It's an intelligent patience. An intelligent patience with the difficulties we might encounter, with our own limitations. We're bouncing off our limitations, of course. But this is, the patience can include measures to change our ways of going about a routine in meditation. Because we're doing it from a conscious place, not from an impatient, oh, I don't like this, I need to change this. You know, the kind of impulsive emotional reactive place. That's not good, of course. Then, of course, patience has its good place, and we should then readjust ourselves and realign ourselves so that we can move forward fresh and new, with a new and fresh mind, or with new and fresh mindfulness, as we tend to say. Okay. Thank you for the question.